Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Amna Nawaz is away. On the News Hour tonight, a top Hamas leader is assassinated in Iran. The implications for the war in Gaza and the broader Middle East. Donald Trump and Kamala Harris try to make inroads with voters in crucial swing states ahead of November's elections. And Judy Woodruff takes a closer look at whether the news media is making political polarization worse.
I think a lot of people now turn to the media to be reinforced in what they believe, rather than to learn something new.
Welcome to the News Hour. The top political leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, was killed overnight in Tehran, just hours after an Israeli airstrike killed one of the top military leaders of Hezbollah in Beirut. Taken together after 10 months of war in Gaza, the attacks escalated fears that a simmering regional conflict could explode into a new and more dangerous phase. Nick Schifrin starts our coverage.
In the hours before his death, Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh met Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's new president, and with Iranian lawmakers, pledged the victory he spent his life promising. It was his final public expression. Overnight, he and his Iranian bodyguard were killed in what Hamas and Iran described as an Israeli drone strike. Iran immediately vowed vengeance. Khamenei posted, "It is our duty to take revenge." And the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said Israel will, quote, face a harsh and painful response from the powerful and huge resistance front, especially Islamic Iran. That threat of regional war was repeated today by Iranian proxies in Yemen, the Houthis, and in Lebanon by Hezbollah and Hamas, which vowed to take the battle with Israel to, quote, new dimensions. But it was met with defiance by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We are prepared for any scenario and will stand united and determined against any threat. Israel will exact a heavy price from any aggression against us on any front.
Never again is now.
And 1 week after his address to Congress, Netanyahu today suggested defying the U.S. led to Israel's military successes.
All the achievements that we've made in recent months, we achieved because we did not give in, because we made courageous decisions despite the great pressure at home and abroad.
Israel didn't make any formal statement about Haniyeh today, but Defense Minister Yoav Gallant visited the Arrow missile defense system designed to protect from Iranian missiles.
Your actions give us the confidence and space to make decisions. We do not seek war, but we are preparing for all possibilities.
Haniyeh rose through Hamas's ranks and was an early advocate of Hamas's entering politics. He became Hamas prime minister after it won 2006 parliamentary elections. He nurtured Hamas's connection with and support from Iran. After handing power over to current Hamas leader and October 7th mastermind Yahya Sinwar, he moved to Qatar, where most recently he led Hamas in ongoing ceasefire talks. Those are hosted by Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, who asked today, how can mediation succeed when one party assassinates the negotiator on the other side?
This is something we were not aware of or involved in.
In Asia today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken called ceasefire talks the priority.
The imperative of getting a ceasefire, the importance that that has for everyone remains. And we will continue to labor that for as long as it takes to get there.
But Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin also promised to defend Israel from Iranian and Hezbollah attacks.
If Israel is attacked, we certainly will help defend Israel. You saw us do that in April. You can expect to see us do that again. But we don't want to see any of that happen. We're going to work hard to make sure that you know we're doing things to help take the temperature down and address issues through diplomatic means.
But across the region, diplomats tell PBS NewsHour diplomacy feels a long way off. Hezbollah was already poised to respond to Israel's assassination, also yesterday, of its most senior military officer, Fuad Shukr. Hezbollah today confirmed his death and posted new photos of Shukr next to Hezbollah and Iran's most senior officials. And so the risk tonight is that a war in Gaza the U.S. was already trying to end would instead spread. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
For more on the killing of the Hamas leader in Iran, we get two views now. Nathan Brown, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, and Hanin Gadar, the Friedman Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank. Thank you both for being with us. Hanin, I'll start with you. A question about the timing and location, coming right after the killing of a top Hezbollah commander in Beirut, and that this happened in Tehran following the inaugural of Iran's new president. What message does this send to Iran?
Good evening. Thank you for having me. This is basically the main question. What's happening now? Like, Israel could have responded with one assassination or one attack on Hezbollah after the Majd al-Shams incident. But I think the message with the assassination of Fuad Shukr in Lebanon and the assassination of Haniyeh in Tehran, also, at the same time, there has been some U.S. strikes in Iraq against the Shia militias, the Iran-backed Shia militias. According to the Hezbollah perspective, the Iran's perspective, what they see is a coordinated attack. Maybe it's not a coordinated attack, but this could be a message of pushing for deterrence, deterring Iran, not necessarily inviting Iran for war. I feel that today, Hezbollah and the IRGC are facing a catch-22. In the sense that they do not want to reach a full-scale war because this is not their war and this is not something that they want to go for. But at the same time, they have to respond. They have to walk a very thin line in terms of what kind of response they have to achieve. And they want to move from this episode as fast as possible because they want to avoid the full-scale war at all costs. But the assassinations of these two senior people, because Fuad Shukr is number two in Hezbollah, right after Hassan Nasrallah, this is a big blow. And they want to stop bleeding all these commanders. They have lost 400 militants, including high-ranked commanders since October 7, and they cannot afford to continue losing them. So if it's done right, if diplomacy steps in today, if it's done right, diplomacy can actually force an agreement and a deterrence for Hezbollah rather than a full-scale war. It depends how it goes. For Hezbollah, I think they're desperate for this to stop.
Nathan Brown, what impact does Haniyeh's killing have on Hamas? Does it degrade their ability to keep fighting in Gaza and in the occupied West Bank?
I don't think it does anything with regard to their fighting ability on the ground in Gaza or in the West Bank. And the important thing to remember about Hamas is this is an organization. Haniyeh was extremely prominent. He will be replaced. I think what it does do is remove perhaps the figure who was most representative of Hamas, most experienced in politics, one of the most experienced people diplomatically. So it may set back diplomatic efforts a little bit. It doesn't change the logic behind the diplomacy, but it does take out one of the very, very key players in the negotiations about a ceasefire.
Hanin, when Iran's supreme leader says that we have a duty to take revenge, what form might that take? What would that look like?
There will be a response because Israel hit Dahiyeh, which is the southern suburbs in Beirut. The last time Israel hit Dahiyeh, it's when they killed Hamas leader Saleh al-Arouri at the beginning of this conflict. And they hit Tehran in the middle of to kill Ismail Haniyeh. It's not about the people. It's also about the location. The pressure of all these factors will push Iran and Hezbollah to respond. However, this is not their war. They both said from the very beginning, in all their statements, that this is the Palestinian war, it's not our war. They're there only to support. So I would imagine the response would be a little bit different from the former responses that we've seen since October 7. Because Saleh al-Arouri was in charge of Iran's precision-guided missiles program, they might use one of these missiles that they haven't used in the war so far, just to send a message saying that we can also cross certain red lines. They can hit deeper into Israel, avoiding the north and the Golan, which is the usual territory for their bombings. They can hit definitely some military facilities. I don't think that they will risk hitting any civilian or residential areas. They do not want to kill Israeli civilians because they saw what happened when they killed children and civilians in the Majd al-Shams last week. They will respond, but it will be very limited. It will be very calculated, because they want to respond in a way that Israel can tolerate and move on from, because they want this episode to be over. I would expect a response that is a little bit different, but not too severe.
Nathan Brown, there had been some optimism from the White House that we were in the closing stages of these ceasefire talks. What happens now, and to what degree do these two killings elevate the prospects of a wider war in the region?
Well, in terms of the ceasefire, it's not clear that there was a deal to be had. It's not actually clear at this point that Israel really wants what would be recognizable as a ceasefire, certainly not a sustained one. It sets those diplomatic efforts back, but it wasn't clear how much traction they would get. In terms of a wider conflict, I mean, I do basically agree that what you have in this odd situation in which the various actors, Israel on the one hand, Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, really talk in very, very tough, almost existential terms about the nature of the other side being an enemy. And yet they're fairly calculated in what they do. And so the risk of a regional war, of this broadening, is very, very real. But up until this point, throughout almost 10 months of war, mutual deterrence has worked to keep Israel from attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon more broadly for a full-scale war or that kind of response. Whether that can continue or not is unclear, but I would agree that the pattern of the last 10 months is both sides do things that will that really strike out at the other side, but are calculated to stop just short of sparking a full-scale conflict.
Nathan Brown and Hanin Gadar, thank you both for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Israeli airstrike on a senior Hezbollah leader yesterday came after 10 months of low-level conflict between the militants and Israel. For insights into Hezbollah's military and political influence, special correspondent Simona Fultin recently traveled to its southern Beirut stronghold, beginning at the funeral of another Hezbollah commander assassinated by Israeli forces.
Even without an invasion, Hezbollah and Israel are already at war. Hezbollah has buried some 350 operatives since October. That's more than in 2006, when Israel last invaded. The death toll includes senior commanders like Mohammad Nasser, who was killed in an Israeli drone strike at the beginning of July.
He is one of the icons of the resistance.
The funeral is in Dahiyeh, Hezbollah's southern Beirut stronghold. Sheikh Abdallah is a Hezbollah supporter and didn't want to give his full name.
What kind of impact do you think an assassination of such a senior commander has on the organization of Hezbollah?
It's not going to change anything. Those people, they believe that martyrdom is the way of the life. He died as a martyr, so he's still alive, and his blood is going to awaken all the people to see whatever the oppression is happening on Gaza, on Palestine, because the people there are suffering. Families has been wiped out. Children has been killed. Parts and pieces of humans in front of our TVs, and nobody's moving. Nobody's saying anything.
It was Hezbollah that started this round of fighting to show support for its ally Hamas. And it will only stop when there's a ceasefire in Gaza.
These targeted assassinations have not deterred Hezbollah, nor do they seem to have impeded its ability to carry out operations. Quite to the contrary, each strike prompts a counterstrike, and it's this gradual escalation that risks pushing the two sides to all-out war.
To discuss the conflict, I sat down with Ibrahim Moussaoui, a member of parliament for Hezbollah's political wing.
There is concern in the region and internationally that Lebanon and Israel could slide into another all-out war. How likely do you think it is at this stage?
The possibility is always there. I don't want to say that, deny that there is a possibility to happen. Maybe Netanyahu himself wants this because he wants to drag the Americans to the Middle East quagmire. But I believe the Israeli military is not ready for that. The international community, the United States, does not want that. And we don't want an all-out war from our side.
At the same time, there is no viable path to peace. While Hezbollah insists on a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel wants a buffer zone on its northern border. President Biden's envoy, Amos Hochstein, has tried to bridge the divide and broker a deal as part of which Hezbollah would pull back from the border.
Under what conditions would Hezbollah accept such a proposal?
It's first of all, the United States is not an honest broker or mediator to suggest. The American administration is a full partner with the, all of the genocide that is taking place in Gaza and with all of the aggressions that are taking place in Lebanon. We still have lands that are occupied by the Israelis. It's the same cause, it's the same enemy, it's the same occupation and the same hostilities. The first thing that should happen, they should make a ceasefire, they should stop the Israeli killing machine, and after that, when the ceasefire is enacted, there it will be enacted here.
Hezbollah knows Lebanon cannot afford all-out war. The country has been crippled by an economic and financial crisis for years, with many Lebanese already struggling to make ends meet.
You're a Lebanese group. Your responsibility is primarily to the Lebanese people, and there are many Lebanese who believe that this is not Lebanon's war, that Lebanon has plenty of other problems.
The majority of the Lebanese, they support what we're doing now. This is a defensive war against the Israeli aggression, as part of our land is under occupation. And when we come to defend ourselves, they want to hold us responsible and to make the calculations. If the international community addressed this properly, we wouldn't have seen any kind of resistance.
A ceasefire in Gaza could provide an off-ramp, but it wouldn't address the roots of this long-running conflict. The border between Lebanon and Israel was never demarcated. Both sides lay claim to 14 disputed areas. This latest war has further deepened animosities.
But we do not recognize Israel. When you say Israel, Israel is an occupying force. It is a kind of cancerous existence that has been installed into the body of the region. We will never recognize Israel as a normal entity here. We are in a war of liberation to our land. The Palestinians is in a war of liberation to their land. And this is something that will continue as long as this occupation, as long as the hostility continues.
Previous attempts to mend the rifts have failed. According to a 2006 UN resolution, Hezbollah was to hand over border security to the Lebanese army, which was never implemented.
Would you agree with me that Hezbollah has not complied with Resolution 1701?
We believe we have complied with everything that would respect our sovereignty, that would defend our people, that would keep our land intact.
Hezbollah is deeply embedded in Lebanon's south. Mousawi says that international calls to remove its fighters are implausible.
The Hezbollah fighters are the sons of the families that are living there in the villages, you see? So if it hadn't been an attack or hostility, you wouldn't have seen the sons and the fathers and the brothers coming to fight the occupation.
And it's the people of the south who are once again bearing the brunt. All along the border, villages have been laid to waste.
Now, some observers are saying that once there is a ceasefire in Gaza, Israel will have sufficient capacity to then turn its attention to Lebanon. So what will be Hezbollah's response if the strikes on Lebanon continue?
In Arabic, ahla wa sahla, ya marhab, ahla wa sahla. They are welcome and they can try it. We are ready more than enough to deal them devastating blows. They are not going to be able to destroy or do anything to us without having a reprisal and a retaliation that is not equal, it could be above also.
Neither side may want all-out war, but that's where the path could lead if a political solution remains elusive. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simona Foltin in Beirut.
Guilty pleas stemming from the September 11th terrorist attacks lead our other headlines. Defense Department officials say Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two of his accomplices have agreed to plead guilty to charges related to the deaths of nearly 3,000 people. The men have been in U.S. custody in Guantanamo Bay for more than two decades. They're expected to enter their pleas as soon as next week. In Colorado, authorities say one person has been killed in a wildfire north of the town of Lyons. The Stone Canyon fire erupted yesterday afternoon. Earlier today, it was listed as 0% contained as 150 firefighters battled the blaze. To the north, the larger Alexander Mountain fire is also spreading. They're among the nearly 100 large fires burning across the western U.S. Meantime, in California, some people returned to their scorched communities after the massive park fire barreled through. That includes the town of Cohasset, which is now unrecognizable.
This community is going to need a lot of support and a lot of aid. There are people that live up here with little to no means, and they just lost kind of everything that they owned or everything that they ever had.
In the Northeast, it's a very different picture. More storms are in the forecast in northern Vermont as residents clean up the mess left by debilitating rain and flooding. The state's governor said today that crews are still rebuilding after severe flooding hit earlier this month.
Seeing all the progress they've made since the flooding 3 weeks ago being washed away again, it probably feels much worse than a punch or a kick. It's simply demoralizing.
And in Georgia, one man is dead after a tree fell on his car during a round of severe thunderstorms last night. They also caused damage in South Carolina and left hundreds of thousands without electricity, though power has since been restored. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has asked his country's Supreme Court to audit the results of Sunday's contested presidential election. But international observers condemned the audit, saying the top court wouldn't be impartial. Meantime, even Maduro's allies are calling for more transparency. President Gustavo Petro of neighboring Colombia called on the embattled leader to prove his re-election victory by releasing detailed vote counts. And Brazilian President Lula da Silva has called for the same. U.S. officials today echoed that view with increasing frustration.
Our patience and that of the international community is running out. It's running out on waiting for the Venezuelan electoral authorities to come clean and release the full detailed data on this election so that everyone can see the results.
Meantime, federal officials have arrested a former U.S. Green Beret over a failed plot back in 2020 to remove President Nicolas Maduro. An indictment unsealed this week in Tampa, Florida, accuses Jordan Goudreau of 14 counts related to violating arms control laws, smuggling, and conspiracy. Goudreau said at the time that he and others were acting to protect Venezuela's democracy. The Biden administration announced a series of proposals today aimed at pushing Congress to do more to stop the flow of illicit fentanyl from Mexico. They include legislation to create a national pill press registry. That's to track machines that could make the pills. Classifying fentanyl as a Schedule I drug, which would increase penalties for traffickers, and tightening rules on small packages coming into the U.S. that would close a loophole often used to import the substances used to make illicit fentanyl. Fentanyl overdoses are a leading cause of death for Americans age 18 to 45. In South Carolina, death by firing squad is now a legal method of execution after the state's Supreme Court ruled it's not considered cruel and unusual punishment. The ruling allows inmates to choose between that and the electric chair as alternatives to lethal injection. South Carolina has executed 43 inmates since 1976, when the death penalty was legalized under federal law. But the state hasn't carried out an execution since 2011, and the state's supplies of drugs for lethal injection have expired. 32 inmates are currently on South Carolina's death row. The Federal Reserve held steady on interest rates today, as expected, but noted that there has been further progress on tackling inflation. The central bank added that if prices continue to cool, an interest rate cut, quote, could be on the table at its September meeting. But Chair Jerome Powell noted that nothing is guaranteed.
Certainty is not a word that we have in our business. So we get a lot of data between now and September, and it isn't going to be one data read or even two. It's going to be the totality of the data, all of the data, and not just it, and then how is that affecting the outlook and how is it affecting the balance of risks? That's going to be the assessment that we do.
Powell also said that maintaining a solid labor market will be part of the Fed's considerations when it comes to any action on interest rates. The next U.S. jobs report is due out on Friday. Wall Street, meantime, welcomed those signals that a rate cut could be coming soon. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added nearly 100 points, inching closer to that 41,000-point level. The NASDAQ jumped more than 450 points as big technology stocks surged. And the S&P 500 enjoyed its best day in 5 months. Still to come on the NewsHour, how the news Americans consume is contributing to political divides, and the latest on the athletes going for the gold at the Paris Olympics.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump and his new Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, are sharpening their attacks as they make their case directly to voters. But as Lisa Desjardins reports, some of Mr. Trump's comments on the campaign trail today are drawing new criticism.
In Chicago, a first for former President Trump.
I love the black population of this country.
The Republican sat down for an interview at the National Association of Black Journalists convention, and it quickly turned combative with ABC's Rachel Scott.
I don't think I've ever been asked a question so in such a horrible manner, a first question.
She asked Trump about other Republicans who called Vice President Kamala Harris a DEI or diversity pick. Trump didn't answer directly, but instead said,
I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
Harris has never shied away from her black and South Asian heritage. She attended Howard University, one of the nation's leading historically black colleges. Trump was later asked about remarks from his vice presidential candidate, J.D. Vance, who in 2021 blasted some single women as childless cat ladies and suggested Americans with children should get more votes. Trump explained it this way.
My interpretation is he's strongly family-oriented, but that doesn't mean if you don't have a family, there's something wrong with it.
Later, the topic was January 6th, and given the assaults, some of them brutal, on 140 police officers that day, Trump was asked if he still would pardon those responsible.
If they're innocent, I would pardon them.
They've been convicted.
And by the way, the Supreme Court just under... Well, they were convicted by a very tough system.
An aide with the Harris campaign wrote on social media that the appearance was, quote, an absolute disaster. The interview had already been controversial with journalists in the association, given Trump's attacks on the press and with black reporters in the past. Karen Attia, a Washington Post columnist, stepped down as co-chair of the NABJ convention in part over this, posting on X that she was not informed of the decision to interview Trump. Vice President Harris isn't expected at the journalists' convention, but is in talks to speak to NABJ members in September. But at a rally in Atlanta last night, she called out Trump by name after he backed away from a scheduled debate.
As the saying goes, if you've got something to say, say it to my face.
The Harris rally had plenty of star power, including a performance from rapper Megan Thee Stallion. Harris took aim at Trump and the conservative Project 2025.
Just look at his Project 2025 agenda. I take it you've seen it.
This after the head of Project 2025, working with the Conservative Heritage Foundation, stepped down yesterday amid criticism and calls from the Trump campaign for it to end. Heritage says the work started by Project 2025 and the dozens of former Trump administration officials who shaped it will continue. But in Atlanta, Harris deployed another rhetorical weapon, a new adjective hurled at the Trump campaign more and more in recent days.
And by the way, don't you find some of their stuff to just be plain weird?
Across the country in Nevada last night, Trump's VP candidate Vance tried out a counter response.
We don't want a wacky San Francisco liberal serving as commander in chief. We don't want Kamala Harris.
As voters think about both campaigns, Harris has virtually sewn up the Democratic nomination. The party announced last night she is the only candidate who qualified to compete for the nomination. That vote will be virtual, starting tomorrow and ending Monday. Both parties and campaigns are heating up, with Trump in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, tonight. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
And joining us now from former President Trump's rally in Harrisburg is Laura Barone Lopez. Laura, thanks so much for being with us. And look, as we saw, Donald Trump started his day in Chicago for what was an at times tense Q&A at the National Association of Black Journalists convention. How is his campaign responding to the criticism he's now facing for his comments about Vice President Harris's racial identity? And what do his comments reveal about how he is approaching running against Harris instead of President Biden?
Jeff, former President Donald Trump, as well as his campaign, are defending themselves and the way he is going after Kamala Harris, despite the fact that some Republicans in his party think that they should refrain from talking about her race and refrain from attacks calling her a DEI hire. But largely, Jeff, Trump's campaign has not changed its strategy when it comes to its attacks on Kamala Harris. They are using a lot of the same attacks that they used on President Joe Biden, namely attacking her on her immigration record as well as on inflation. One big difference, though, is that Donald Trump is trying to define Kamala Harris as being much more to the left of Joe Biden on issues like climate and guns. But I talked to two Republican sources today, Jeff. One who is close to Trump world, who said that he believes that the campaign is still struggling to figure out how to undercut the momentum that Kamala Harris has right now. And another GOP strategist in a swing state told me that they think that the campaign has not found their footing against Harris, and that strategist admitted that it really feels like Obama-level enthusiasm for Harris right now.
Well, this is Donald Trump's first rally back in Pennsylvania after that assassination attempt. You've been talking to his supporters today. What have they told you?
Multiple voters that I spoke to here, Jeff, said that they wanted to be here because of the fact that it was his first rally here since the assassination attempt. And like a number of Trump allies and some Republican lawmakers, the voters that I spoke to here echoed conspiracy theories about the assassination attempt, including two voters that I spoke to from nearby Pennsylvania counties.
It was all rigged. I can't understand how the Secret Service left all that evidence slide by them.
Rigged by whom?
I think it was rigged by the Democrats.
I really firmly believe, I'm not a conspiracy person at all, but I believe the Secret Service is covering up a lot of stuff, and I think somebody should come and pay the price.
We heard a lot of that from voters here, Jeff. We also heard voters also told me that they believed the lie from Donald Trump that 2024, in addition to 2020, is going to be a rigged election. And when it comes to the policy issues, a number of them said that border security, immigration, as well as the economy are their main issues. And when I asked them about Vice President Kamala Harris becoming the likely Democratic nominee, they said that they didn't think Harris would be harder for Donald Trump to beat than Joe Biden, and they weren't necessarily concerned about her becoming the Democratic nominee.
Laura, what about Donald Trump's running mate, J.D. Vance? How were his supporters, at least those folks in Pennsylvania and Harrisburg that you spoke to today, how are they responding to that?
Well, despite the fact that J.D. Vance has been criticized lately and Democrats have been attacking him specifically about his comments about the government being run by childless women and questioning whether people who don't have children actually have a stake in the future of the country. A lot of the voters here either said that they didn't know much about J.D. Vance, that the jury was still out, and others said that they were, like this voter from New York, said that they were looking to trust Donald Trump on his pick.
I didn't know too much about J.D. Vance. I'm doing my research. I don't take anybody for face value anymore. There's a lot of rhinos out there, and I'm just hoping that President Trump, you know, is working from a higher place and he picked the best man for the job. And like I said, the verdict's still out as far as I'm concerned.
So a lot of the voters here didn't necessarily think that J.D. Vance was a drag on the ticket, but that GOP source that I spoke to earlier, Jeff, did say, and other Republican sources that I've talked to, think that J.D. Vance could ultimately harm Donald Trump.
Meantime, Laura, Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from Project 2025. This is this blueprint for a second Trump term. The architect of that proposal, a guy named Paul Danz, he was reportedly pushed out of the conservative Heritage Foundation by the Trump team. Bring us up to speed and give us a reality check here.
Donald Trump's campaign yesterday, Jeff, said that claimed again that they have nothing to do with Project 2025, and they said that Project 2025's demise would be, quote, greatly welcomed. But Project 2025 isn't going anywhere, Jeff. And Heritage Foundation Kevin Roberts issued a statement saying that, quote, Project 2025 was built for any future administration to use. Project 2025 will continue our efforts to build a personnel apparatus for policymakers of all levels, federal, state, and local. And that last part there is key, Jeff, because a lot of the leaders that were in charge of crafting Project 2025, including Paul Dantz, said over and over again that this blueprint was created so that way conservative warriors could then be ready to enter into a second Trump administration. And a lot of the people that authored Project 2025 worked in Donald Trump's administration, Jeff.
Laura Barone Lopez covering a Trump rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania tonight. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Despite having access to more information than ever before, Americans' trust in the news media has been declining in recent years. And nearly three-quarters of Americans say the news media is making political polarization worse. Judy Woodruff investigates as part of her ongoing series, America at a Crossroads.
Step back and think about that.
So I listen to Fox News. I listen to Newsmax. I will go to CNN to see what they're saying.
Jerry Leviser is a Republican committeewoman in Haverhill, Massachusetts.
Do we want to do heavy traffic time, like 4 to 7 again?
Absolutely. Or
do you? Okay.
Yeah.
On a hot evening this July, she and a handful of fellow Republicans were working on their plans to show support for former President Trump, while Fox News played in the background.
Attempt to enforce their vision for America, but it's not based off meritocracy. It's based off racism, quite frankly, and it's based off neo-Marxism.
I think that President Trump gets a, not that Fox is pro-Trump, but I think he gets a better interpretation of his values and what he stands for from Fox. MSNBC is much more likely to insult Republicans as opposed to insulting a Democrat.
The Supreme Court is a clear and present danger to their entire political agenda.
Across town, Demet Haksaver, who immigrated to the United States from Turkey in 1975, is watching MSNBC.
In the morning, I start watching MSNBC, Morning Joe, CNN, sometimes PBS, other sources, BBC. And at night, I tune in to MSNBC.
Haksaver is a retired economist who's now involved with Indivisible, a grassroots political group dedicated to opposing the Republican Party.
And why do you prefer MSNBC, do you think?
Well, I like their focus on the issues that are important to me.
What about Fox?
Oh, Fox? No, I gave up on Fox a long time ago.
Haksaver and Leviser are not unique. A 2023 survey by the Associated Press found that 26% of Democrats and 60% of Republicans have little or no trust in the news media. And research by YouGov in 2024 showed Democrats were more likely to trust a wider range of sources than Republicans, who were far more inclined, like Leviser, to primarily trust Fox and Newsmax.
The national news is more polarized, certainly on broadcast and cable, and it's much less reportage and much more opinion.
Martha Minow is a professor and former dean of Harvard Law School, whose book, Saving the News, looks at how the news media has been transformed under declining government regulation and increasing economic and political pressure.
Political parties funded newspapers in the 1840s, 50s, 60s. The journalism that developed in the 1880s into the golden age of the 1960s was the first time that objectivity was elevated as an ideal, that really recognized we need multiple sources, we need to be transparent, we need to actually document, we need to have a counterpoint.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News.
That also just happened to be good business, to advertise to the most people, which paid for publication. Newspapers and broadcasters had an incentive to aim for objectivity.
This picture has just been transmitted by wire.
In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, television news reporting was primarily limited to the three major networks, CBS, ABC, and NBC. With only a handful of channels available for broadcast, the government issued licenses to the networks and also put regulations in place to ensure fair treatment in their coverage, like the Fairness Doctrine, enacted in 1949.
The Fairness Doctrine was part of the entrance of the federal government in the regulation of access to the airwaves for television, radio. You have to have balance. And if there is a presentation of one point of view, you have to have a contrary point of view. If a public official were attacked, they had a right to reply.
Good evening. I'm David Walker.
And I'm Lois Hart. Now here's the news.
But as cable TV grew in popularity and dozens of new channels came on the air, all viewers had to do to get a contrary point of view was change the channel, in theory. So the Fairness Doctrine was phased out by President Ronald Reagan's FCC in 1987, setting the stage for a radical transformation in the way Americans got their news.
I think a lot of people now turn to the media to be reinforced in what they believe, rather than to learn something new.
Minow says cable networks like MSNBC, Fox News, and others now pursue smaller audiences on the left or the right, sometimes called narrowcasting, by leaning into opinion coverage that those viewers will agree with.
Kamala Harris has a horrific track record, even worse public persona.
She has different superpowers and different areas she will need to work on to appeal to voters than President Biden.
Opinion media is more successful than news media, than journalism. I think it's related to this lack of curiosity, people looking to be reinforced. Also, it's more expensive. You know this. It's yes. More expensive to actually interview people, to look at documents, to actually explore without knowing ahead of time what is your story. Being able to convert a story into something that's very simple, digestible, and maybe even outraging is more successful. It attracts attention. It's what people talk about.
Breaking just now, an illegal immigrant from Ecuador arrested, apprehended, under arrest, suspected of sexually assaulting, as you said, a teenage girl in a New York City park.
Recently, there was a 13-year-old girl in New York that's been raped by an illegal that's crossed into this country. He tied up the little boy that was with her, gagged them, and nothing comes out of the White House about how horrible this is.
According to a new analysis from NBC News, quote, despite several horrifying high-profile incidents, there is no evidence of a migrant-driven crime wave in the United States. In fact,
they are just cherry-picking terrible crimes by immigrants, but they don't mention ever the positive contributions of the immigrants to our communities, to this country.
But is partisan news media, in fact, creating more division in the country? Or are partisan viewers now finding their way to more friendly outlets?
So I've been focused on polarization almost my whole career.
Professor Matt Levandusky is a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania. His research shows that watching certain channels does have an impact on viewers' political opinions.
We showed people the kind of Fox coverage, the MSNBC coverage, or kind of a mainstream news coverage. And what we found was that people tended to move in the direction of the source, right, especially if it was a source that was congenial to them.
How do you see the role of the news media and any bias or slant in the news media in affecting the way most people think about issues?
Well, there's certainly an effect. I think people who are actively involved in politics tend to be quite polarized, but the country as a whole still has room to come together, find common ground. But the factor working against that is that politicians often have an incentive to divide people.
Levandusky says both the news media and political leaders, who are often recruited from the political extremes during primaries, have played a role in deepening our divisions.
Venezuela is releasing thousands of people, criminals, gang members, drug dealers, the worst.
They are trying to control women's bodies quite explicitly. And
so if you look at studies about the kinds of people that run for Congress, they're increasingly being drawn from people who are more on the extremes rather than the middle, because the people who are in the middle sort of look out at Congress and they say, where am I going to fit in? So it's pushing people and kind of stretching them out a little bit more towards the extremes.
Well, the thing is, early voting starts in September.
Jerry Leviser has felt the impact of this growing polarization in her own community and even her own family.
I do have a brother who is very liberal, so we just don't talk politics at all, ever.
And what about where they get their news?
They would never watch Fox or Newsmax or it's MSNBC.
Right, this is how they make it in Turkey, actually.
But 10 minutes down the road, Demet Haksaver sees an even greater threat in the coverage coming from Fox, especially its promotion of conspiracy theories about the 2020 presidential election.
The disinformation they spread it about the validity of the election results, 2020, it poses a great risk to our democracy. I come from Turkey, and we lost our democracy because of the same divisions.
What happens to a democracy in a situation like that?
Well, democracy dies in that case.
Harvard's Martha Minow says there is no easy solution to this problem. More nonprofit media funding local journalism and fighting disinformation could all help. But she remains deeply concerned about how these divisions are affecting our communities.
The lack of a shared reality is a crisis in America right now. And you can see this depending on what your preferences are. You flip channels or whatever. You see it's different topics, and when it's the same topic, there has no relationship. And if you don't share a reality, and indeed you think the people next to you are out to get you, it's not just democracy that's at risk. It's peaceful coexistence.
In an upcoming installment of America at a Crossroads, we'll look at how the internet and social media have only accelerated this concerning trend. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Judy Woodruff in Haverhill, Massachusetts.
At the Paris Olympics, swimming star Katie Ledecky cruised to gold in the 1500-meter race today. The 27-year-old American finished nearly half a pool length ahead of her competitors. As Ledecky dominated the pool, others swam in the Seine. Triathletes took their first plunge into the river following days of concerns about water quality. Meantime, Coco Gauff's Olympics were cut short. The Team USA flag bearer lost two doubles matches today. Overall, though, the U.S. remains on top of the total medal count, with 30 overall. France and China are second and third. It all comes as the U.S. gymnastics team celebrate their historic performances yesterday and get ready for their individual finals still to come. For more, I spoke earlier with USA Today's Christine Brennan. Christine Brennan, welcome back to the NewsHour.
It's great to be with you, Jeff. Thank you.
So let's start with the U.S. women's gymnastics team, because they've named themselves the Golden Girls. This is the oldest U.S. women's team since 1952, and they're still winning gold. They finished nearly 6 points ahead of the silver medal winners, Italy, with Brazil grabbing the bronze. What does that say about the changing nature of the sport and its athletes?
You know, Jeff, this has been a national conversation, a cultural conversation in the U.S. about how we look at young women, body image, the issue of eating disorders, anorexia. These are conversations that we have had at the very top elite level of sport, but we've also had those conversations in our kitchens with our daughters and nieces and granddaughters and just been on the, you know, having much more awareness, frankly, of those issues over the last, say, you know, 10 or 15 years. And look at the result. A team that America cares and the world cares so much about, led by the great Simone Biles, the gymnastics team. We were so used to seeing them look so thin. We'd hear about the injuries, the horrors, of course, of the Larry Nassar, the sexual assault scandal, the worst sex abuse scandal in sports history, including Simone Biles, the survivor in that from those horrors. We've dealt with all of this, and look at the result now. You've got these women, as you said, the Golden Girls, perfect name for them, in their 20s. Simone Biles is 27. this is an age that would never have been on the radar screen 20 years ago in gymnastics. And yet here we are now. So not only are they the greatest in the world athletically, but they truly are a symbol of what we have been discussing as a nation in terms of how we look at women and young girls.
The men's gymnastics team also made history this past week in a different way. That team earned bronze, making it the first time in 16 years the U.S. men's team finished on the podium in Olympic competition. You've also got Steven Nedorasik, the America's pommel horse hero. How big a moment is this for the men's team?
Oh, it's fantastic, and it's terrific. And Nedorasik, my goodness, the Clark Kent, right, with his glasses on, the memes and the photos that have gone viral of him waiting for his moment, picked just for the one event, the pommel horse. He goes out there and he nails it, and he then, of course, ensures the bronze medal for the U.S. men. Extraordinary moment. And these are the moments, Jeff, that really, I think, attract people to the Olympic Games, even after the competition, after someone has finished competing. So here he is now. He has entered everyone's home or on our devices on social media. You've seen him. You know him. You want to find out a little bit more about him. And he's the one that is going through and doing the Rubik's Cube in, like, you know, 15, 20 seconds. And he's online now showing those videos. So I love that for him and the entire team. So deserving of the accolades after all of these years where the men have just been completely out of the headlines.
We're also paying close attention to American swimmer Katie Ledecky, who continues to make waves. She almost lapped her competition in the 1500-meter race. Talk to us about her goal of becoming the swimmer with the most medals.
Katie Ledecky is already seen as the greatest female swimmer ever, and only Michael Phelps in terms of just dominance and being decorated with so many medals. Only Michael Phelps is bigger than that. The longer she swims, the better it is for her. And the 1500 is the longest. And she has just once again shown that she is just the greatest in the endurance races. The 1500, the 800 comes later in the week. And it's just a delight to watch her, of course. And not only is a great role model, but again, such a great swimmer. There are seven other swimmers and you don't see any of them because Katie's so far ahead of everyone else.
And Christine, let's talk about the U.S. women's rugby team, which dramatically grabbed the bronze medal. What should we know about that team and their monumental win?
You know, this is fun. This is what the Olympics really is all about. I mean, I'm over here and I'm not covering rugby, but I've had so many friends and family say, what about the rugby team? And their incredible victory to over Australia to at the very last seconds. If people haven't seen it, you know, go and watch it. 90-yard run in the very last seconds for the United States to snatch the bronze medal away from Australia and win it themselves. And this is a team that has been all over social media. And what's really fun about that, and I think it's informative and in many ways kind of groundbreaking, is that 15, 20 years ago, whenever we didn't have social media, that when the Olympics ended, most of these athletes went away. Well, now with social media, and these women are rock stars, and they have got, in some cases, just hundreds of thousands of followers, and that their story now can continue, and their brand, they can sell their brand themselves, and they can continue to be a part of American consciousness. We know that the Olympic Games is very much alluring to those of us who you don't see these sports very often. And so once every 4 years, you tune in and you're enchanted and delighted.
Sports writer and columnist for USA Today, Christine Brennan. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
And we have more coverage of the Olympics online, including a look at Team Palestine that's competing in the Games. That's on our Instagram page. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. On behalf of the entire PBS NewsHour team, thanks for joining us.